in my heart, there's a fire.
James 1, 19 to 25. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. Therefore, get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and, after looking at himself, goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do.
A couple of months ago, my daughter turned 14, and she received a lot of cash for her birthday from her parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles because she wanted to buy herself a new phone. And by new phone, I mean a used phone, which she bought off Kijiji. Now, we warned her about this, and the end of the story is that it turned out fine, but it almost didn't. She arranged the meeting with this guy who was going to sell her this phone at a Starbucks. She said this Starbucks by Costco and Cambridge, and there was a miscommunication. It took us about an hour and a half to actually connect with this person, but in the meantime, we were trying to figure out, like, how will we know who the person selling the phone is? Like, she didn't get any kind of descriptor, and we didn't know who this person was. So we're in a Starbucks, and there are all kinds of people sitting there, and it's like, well, how are we going to know who the one selling the phone is? So I saw, like, maybe a 13, 14-year-old boy sitting there, and I thought, well, we got to go up and ask him if he's the one. And I thought, well, I shouldn't do that, because I could probably get in trouble for approaching a 13-year-old boy sitting alone in Starbucks. But so I sent my son. So I sent Jude to go, and Jude goes and asks, are you selling a phone? The guy's like, no. So he returns kind of red-faced and says, no, he's not the one. Then I saw another guy, kind of young adult. I thought, oh, this must be the guy here. So I went up, hey, are you selling a phone? No. And then I returned somewhat red-faced. Eventually, we figured out that the guy who was selling his phone was at a different Starbucks on the other side of the city. So yeah, it's awkward walking up to like a random stranger and just starting a conversation. It's very awkward, feels uncomfortable. But sometimes it's even more awkward engaging in conversations with people that we know well. What do I mean by that? Well, if we have to talk to someone about something significant, how do we start that conversation? Sometimes it feels like we're walking up to a stranger and asking if they're selling a phone. Well, the section in James' letter begins the way that any meaningful conversation should, with an expression of affection and respect. My dear brothers and sisters. Now, of course, if we actually started our conversations this way, our emails, our texts, our Facebook posts, people would think we're a little off. Just imagine every time you post something on Facebook, you're like, my dear Facebook friends. And then you say whatever you're going to say. Like, it would be awkward. You know, my cat saw its shadow. My dear Facebook friends. Every text you send, you know, to your teenage child, like, my dear son, you know. Could you imagine if their friend got a hold of their phone? Like, what's the matter with your mother? Every text starts with, my dear son. It would be awkward. But the idea is that maybe the people would think that that you care about them. Now, we don't have to use those words, but what James is doing here is he has a challenge ahead of him, and that he is going to talk to these people about something that's challenging. He's going to talk about them about something difficult, and he wants to set the framework in the context of a healthy and loving relationship, in the context of love. And I think that he probably does this for his own benefit as much as for theirs. If you think about it, if you have to have a challenging conversation with someone, probably a good thing to remind yourself about is the fact that this person is a brother or sister, that this person is someone that you love and that you respect. And that also, in doing, you remind them of the same thing. Now, in what follows, James challenges his readers to do two things, the difficult work of listening and the even more difficult work of putting what is heard into action. Now, we're here heading toward the end of a series, taking a look at what we do here on a Sunday morning. Admittedly, it's a little different series than we're used to, but we're taking a look at the different elements from our gathering, the fact that we gather here and we have a call to worship, from the fact that we sing songs together, the fact that we pass around an offering basket and we do announcements, that we hear a reading from Scripture, that we listen to a sermon. And now we find ourselves pondering the part of our service where we engage in discussion and conversation, specifically around tables, in the gym, but also just casually out in the lobby as we chat over coffee and catch up. We're going to ask ourselves the why question. Why do we do what we do in between our time of learning and our time of leaving, which we'll discuss next week as we wrap up this series? Discussion groups are an intentional part of our gathering. There is also this informal part of our gathering, this unintentional piece where people gather in the lobby. I'm not going to be talking about that so specifically, but I think some of the principles that can guide our conversations can be equally applied from the discussion tables out into the lobby. Now, I can remember, actually, in the past, when our church community used to meet at the Waterloo Rec Complex, a number of you were still around when we were doing that. It's been a number of years now. But it was a giant room, and there were kind of two halves to it. And so the movement from kind of the sermon part of this of the service to the discussion, it was really kind of seamless. And in fact, you had to actually walk through where the discussion was happening to the door in order to leave. So we kind of thought we had a good setup there. But people would occasionally just slide out of the habit, and we'd find ourselves with only two or three tables full. So what we would do is that we would trick people, and some of you remember this, we would trick you into being in a discussion group. So I would talk for about 5 minutes of a sermon, and then I'd say, okay, now we're going to break for discussion. And everyone would be like, what? Did I fall asleep again? And then we would have discussion for like 25 minutes and come back, and then I would like do the second part of the sermon. And we would trick everyone to trying it out. Now, we're not going to do that this morning. I know some of you are getting nervous. You're like, oh, dang it. Why did I show up on the long weekend? So we're not going to do that this morning. But the idea was that sometimes people get out of the habit of engaging in discussion. Sometimes people maybe are just afraid of starting it for the first time. And we want to say, just try it. Just engage it. So we're not going to pressure you today, but we do want to encourage participation. When I think back to the very beginnings of this model, it was an experiment that we tried. The year before we launched Elevation, we started something called Embassy Unplugged. So the Embassy was our student church, and it had grown quite quickly and quite large to the point where we were starting to kind of lose touch with people. It was too big of a community to really know everyone. So we said, why don't we do something on Sunday mornings, and we'll just keep it simple and small. And so we would have about 15 or 20 people gathering together. And one of the decisions that we made was incorporating as part of our gathering this time of discussion. And we didn't have tables set up. We would just sit around the floor or sit outside. And I remember one of those conversations where a student from the University of Waterloo said, in the context of that little discussion group sitting outside the building at Hagee Hall at UW, and he said, this is the only time of the week when I get to talk to someone about my faith. And I remember sitting in that discussion group and saying, we will never stop doing this. If this is the only time that someone will have to engage a conversation about faith with someone, then we're never going to stop doing this. And so, as the years gone by, this has become something that has been a part of who we are as a church. But why did we start it in the beginning? I think this is an important thing, and it helps to explain why we value this and also what these groups are supposed to be. James 1:19, again, he says everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. There's this idea that we should kind of allow others to have the voice before we have the voice. And the real reason for starting discussion groups in the first place when we began was that I didn't really like the role of being a talking head on Monday nights at our student church. I was up there, I was the expert, the crowd was out there, I would say everything that I wanted to say, and then say, okay, now go and do it, or whatever I would say at the end. And I kind of felt like this isn't the best way for people to learn in the context of a church. So when we started something new on Sunday mornings, I thought, well, there's a way for us to build into this where I'm not actually the last person to speak. Someone else has an opportunity. And so I think that's an important. When I read James' words, it's what I think about. It's a chance to hear from others as opposed to making sure that you're the one who's heard. And then I think about the verse where he says, do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves, but do what it says. And this is where I ended up last week. I just want to rewind for a moment and repeat the words of Jesus that I read to wrap up my message on learning through the scripture and sermon. This passage comes at the tail end of the most famous sermon of sermons, the Sermon on the Mount. And this is what Jesus says. Everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. And so finding a way to take what we hear and weave it into the fabric of our lives is key. James says something very similar to what Jesus said at the end of that sermon. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. Now, it's hard for us to imagine that. We have mirrors everywhere. We have glass everywhere, reflective surfaces everywhere we go. I realized that a number of years ago in the pre-kids stage of my life. I went on a canoe trip in Algonquin Park with my brothers-in-law, and we were away for like 3 days or something like that. But I remember when we got back to the parking lot, and I looked in the kind of the window of the van that we drove, and I looked at myself, and I was dirty and unshaven and whatever. But it was weird thinking, I have not seen my reflection in 3 days. And I couldn't fathom the last time I'd gone 3 days without seeing my reflection. But it's a weird feeling to kind of forget what you look like. And James is saying, like, that's what it's like. When you hear the word of God, when you hear God's challenge to live this life he's created you to live, and then you don't do it, it's like you forget what you look like. It doesn't make any sense. It's easy to forget what we hear. I acknowledge that. But by being the one up here talking, I realize that it's very difficult to forget what you hear in a given moment like this. But it's less easy to forget what you engage in conversation about. And so another significant reason we gather for discussion groups is to increase the likelihood that we're going to remember the word that was planted in us, and it's going to actually take root and grow. Really, if I talk to someone outside of our church context, this model that we do, having discussion as part of our gatherings, is not something that most, if any, churches do. And so people always ask, like, why do you do that? Why do you choose that? And I kind of say there are three reasons, and these are the three things I want to unpack this morning. We want to make it difficult to get lost. So if you show up here on a Sunday morning and participate all the way through the end of discussion groups, you're going to leave having at least sat down and had a conversation with 7 or 8 people on a first-name basis, getting to know a little bit about who people are. So it's going to be difficult to get lost if you want to, unless you want to. The second reason is that we want to continue the conversation. We want to start the conversation. That's what I think my role in here is, really getting the conversation going, and then we continue it out in the gym around the discussion tables. And then finally, we lean toward application. I'll talk a little bit later about what I mean by that. But again, taking this passage from James, we want to think about not only hearing the word, but figuring out how do we actually put it into action in our lives. And so that's what we want to lean into. So let's start with this idea of making it difficult to get lost. I remember in second year university, I took a personality psychology course with a professor, and he was the first person I ever knew who had 3 initials before his last name. He was Dr. F.R.S. Binding. And I was like, that's impressive to have 3 initials. Like, that's really neat. But he had this kind of obsession with a guy named Eric Fromm, and those of you who study psychology will be familiar with him. I remember at the time him telling me that it was like the 3rd most published book in history or something, which I don't believe is true, but he didn't have Google to fact check that, so I couldn't prove him wrong. But he had this book, and it was called The Escape from Freedom. The idea of Fromm's book was that, you know, Western society for years, for generations, had been striving to achieve freedom and autonomy and independence. However, as much as we want to be free, he said, we don't actually like freedom once we've had it. And so now we're at a place in our history where we're trying to escape from the freedom that we've earned ourselves to try to find community. His thoughts can be summed up with this quote: it seems that nothing is more difficult for the average man to bear than the feeling of not being identified with a larger group. And so we need to escape this freedom and build community. Now, last Sunday morning, someone approached me to share something they hoped I would address in this week's sermon. And as a quick aside, I want to say that I like that. So if you look like in our program this morning, you'll see this thing, next week, right? And we have this on our website as well. And the primary reason that's there is that I want people to be thinking about where we're going, and I actually hope that people will share their thoughts and ideas about this, that someone would look at that scripture and say, that scripture has just been on my mind this week, and I want to share with you, you know, what I've been learning about it. Or that theme is huge. Let me tell you a story about the theme you're going to be talking about next week. I would love to have that kind of input as I'm preparing and getting ready. So that was just a quick aside. So the person talked to me. They said that they would hope I address the importance of understanding who is sitting around the table with us in these discussion groups and avoid jumping to conclusions or making assumptions about who these people are. And they gave a specific example about in a particular discussion group, someone who was exploring faith was being pressed by someone else at the table to give a specific example from their life of how they were applying their faith. And they were kind of sitting here thinking, this person hasn't maybe embraced faith yet, and they don't really understand what you're talking about. And so there's this assumption. So when we talk about this idea of wanting everyone to be there and building the sense of community around that table, this key thing for us to understand is realizing who is around the table with us. That not everyone around that table is like us. They have different experiences. They're at different places on their spiritual journey. We don't get to James' brothers and sisters level unless it's a place where we all belong. And so we need to keep that in mind as we sit down at these tables. How do we make sure that everyone around this table, at their various places along this journey, belong? Martin Thornton says that a church is God's house, which is not fulfilling its function until it is our home, and we are truly at home with it and in it. I like that quote. However, the question of what it means to feel at home is a complicated one. I don't think it means that we get along swimmingly with everyone and we're exactly the same as everyone around us. I mean, think about your own home, right? I don't always like the people who live in my home, and I'm pretty sure they don't always like me either. And you may have a home like that too. But there's something about home that makes that okay, that it's okay to be different than from the people around you. It's okay to not like the person because at a deeper level, you love them and you have a respect for them. And so we need to keep that in mind. Now, of course, there are much more significant opportunities that we have in the church to build relationships, to go deeper. Our midweek groups that happen kind of all through the week, that's a great opportunity. Getting part of a team that is either serving a need in the church or even better, serving out in our community, coming alongside people, building relationships that way. Even just going out for coffee with people. There are lots of ways to really go deeper in relationship. But what we've done by structuring our morning this way is build an opportunity to dabble in community every single week, a chance to dip your toes in, to learn a little bit more about the people around you, and to begin to feel like you belong. Jean Vanier wrote a book called Becoming Human. Jean Vanier is the founder of the LARCH communities, where people with varying levels of developmental ability live alongside one another. And he talks at one point in this book about what he calls four marks of a healthy group. I think these are interesting indicators for a church as a whole, but I think they also could apply when we think about that little table we sit around on a Sunday morning. I'm not going to unpack them in detail, but I just want to read them and cause us to think about why or how these things could be a sign of our discussion groups. The first sign, he says, is an openness to the weak and needy in our own group helps us open our hearts to others in the broader community. And so by engaging in conversation and listening to the needs of others and allowing other people to put their kind of burdens on the table and talk through that, that shapes and forms how we live out our lives for those who are in need in the rest of our week. The second mark, he says, is the way a group humbly lives its mission without manipulation, but listening well and empowering one another. And so sitting around that table isn't about getting your agenda through. It's not about converting everyone to your way of thinking or your specific belief. It's about listening. Thirdly, he says, moving out from behind the walls of certitude, focusing on what unites us instead of the differences that can divide us. It's important to talk about differences, but not focus on them, not make them be the center of our conversation. But however we express our differences, to come around to the point of, but where these are the things we have in common, the more significant things that unite us. And fourthly, he says, when a group seeks to evolve, it's a healthy sign, recognizing errors of the past and seeking outside help to grow. And so as we sit there and participate in these groups, that we're actually open to change and growth, to learning from the experiences of the people sharing around us and putting that into practice in our lives. Then he invites us to look for signs such as healthy bonding, true dialogue where each person is respected, more respectful of differences, more listening and open. So I want us to go into discussion groups today and moving forward thinking about, are these signs visible in our gathering and in our conversation, because this is what we're chasing after. So it's about helping it make it difficult for people to get lost and really build that sense of community. It's also about continuing the conversation. One of our kind of key anchors that helps drive what we do as a church and the decisions we make is something that we say we will create a culture of thoughtful spiritual engagement. That's obviously part of our gathering here, and then it's part of our gathering as we move into the next room as well. What begins in the sanctuary continues in the gym, or as the people from St. John's like to call it, the fellowship hall. And the reason I point that out is that when we started meeting here in our meetings and in our correspondence, I would refer to it as the gym, and then someone on their council said, you know what, I'd actually appreciate it if you would refer to it as the fellowship hall, because that's what it was built for. It wasn't built for athletic activities. It was built for community. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I still refer to it as the gym, but because it's just easier. And because the word fellowship is this awkward church word, right? You only say fellowship if you're in a church or if you're a Lord of the Rings fan. But the idea of the concept that place is a place where community is built and where conversations happen. I love what Marva Don says. True communication is not merely an exchange of information, but the embedding of whatever is discussed within a rich personal relationship. We communicate with someone else, and listen to this, develop meaning together. That's what's happening there. We're continuing this conversation. We are developing meaning together. Great way to think about what we do around those tables. Now, if we go back to the first line of the reading that Marcia read for us, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. And here is the essence of true reflection, true conversation, where we have genuine listening as opposed to hearing. And I'm as guilty of it as the next person. You know, you're hearing what the person's saying, but really you're just formulating an even better example in your head. So that as soon as they breathe, they're like, and you're like, and for me, and you just like jump in there. And so it's an opportunity for us to really practice this being slow to speak and quick to listen. We have lots of opportunities to practice this. Now, one of the concerns that people express about our structure and the kind of conversation is a lack of guidance. Often people who are newish around Elevation say, wait a second, why is no one there like guiding that conversation and making sure it ends in the right place? So imagine that you were in 1995. Try to go back to 1995. And someone tells you, some of you are like, I can't. I wasn't born. That's okay. Just imagine with me. So you're in 1995 and someone tells you, I have two investment opportunities for you. You got to pick one. Two different organizations are going to reinvent the encyclopedia. One of them is a software giant, Microsoft. They are coming out with an encyclopedia on CD-ROM. Some of you don't even know what that is. On CD-ROM, and it is going to have graphics, and it is going to have like video, and it's going to be interactive. You're going to be able to interact as you learn from this encyclopedia. And Microsoft is pushing resources to get the best contributors to this, and it is going to be incredible. So you can invest in that company, or you can invest in this other. And the other business model is, we're not going to ask experts to build an encyclopedia. We're just going to kind of let whoever wants to build an encyclopedia. Anyone can just kind of contribute, and they don't get paid for it, and the company that builds this thing is just going to give it away for free to whoever wants it. Like 100 out of 100 people invest in Microsoft. And yet 14 years after they launched Encarta, Microsoft decided to abandon the entire project, admitting that Wikipedia just had it figured out better. So we think that the idea of like making sure that we've got all it there and the experts are guiding it is the best way to do it. But there's something about us that loves the idea of learning in community and bringing ideas to the table. Now, there's a disclaimer that needs to go along with this. Last week, as we were talking about teaching, there were these repeated cautions that Paul gives to his mentorees in the letters in the New Testament, where he talks about their commitment to sound teaching. So there is an important thing for us to keep an eye out, that making sure that what we're teaching is significant and is true. But there's also something about the conversation. Lord Macaulay once wrote that men are never so likely to settle a question rightly as when they discuss it freely. And so we believe that actually an open and honest conversation is going to get us the best possible answers to the questions that we have. Even in a very different day than our own, Paul, writing to the first century church in Rome, acknowledge the need to accept one another's differences. Romans 14 provides powerful guidelines for how we can explore the complexities of faith together, beginning with Paul's instruction, accept the one whose faith is weak, without quarreling over disputable matters. Now, of course, the key in there, or one of the keys, is this phrase, disputable matters. There may be a point where something is said that is kind of so off base that you need to challenge it. But when it comes to things that people are bound to have different ideas and opinions on, then don't quarrel over it, but turn it an opportunity to learn from one another. Paul would go on in chapter 14, verse 13, to say, therefore, let us stop passing judgment on one another. Instead, make up your mind not to put any stumbling block or obstacle in the way of a brother or sister. It's not to say that we don't challenge, but it's to say that we do so with respect and love. There are those words again, brother or sister. Paul would write elsewhere, let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. So as we engage in this conversation around the table, our conversations are filled with grace and love. Which brings us to the third leg of the stool, application. Leaning toward application. One of my favorite quotes comes from the very witty Mark Twain, who said, I knew a man who grabbed a cat by the tail and learned 40% more about cats than the man who didn't. You can just imagine what you would learn. And so moving from learning to application, this is a key thing that James talks about, and we need to think about this. Last week, as I was writing the sermon, I took some time on one of those hot days we had. I was sitting out in the garden out back here on the property, and this elderly gentleman came up to me, and he kind of asked how it was going. I was like, oh, it's going good. I said, it's kind of weird, though. I said, I keep having to clean off the keyboard and screen of my laptop because it's getting covered with pollen. And he's like, oh, yeah. And I thought about my car, you know, that morning, which basically was covered with this thin film of yellow pollen. And I said, well, I guess it's a good sign. And he said, actually, he said, an excess of pollen is a sign of stress. It's a sign that trees are going through stress, and they're doing everything they can to kind of reproduce, but it can actually harm them. And so I was thinking, okay, it's like the trees are trying too hard. They don't need to do this, but they think that they do. I thought about that because as I stand up here on a Sunday morning, I have to think about the difference between application and implication. And a decision that I made a long time ago was to settle on implication for this portion of the gathering and application for the next. I don't want to get to the end of the sermon and say, okay, now this is what you need to do. Everything I've said, I've had this wonderful argument, and now you need to do A, B, and C this week. That's application. That's telling you what to do. But I want to kind of open some questions and then say, gathering around those tables, that's when we figure out how to apply this word that we've been hearing. That's how we wrestle with that together. I read a piece from a Catholic document that outlines, you know, some of the description of what a priestly vocation is, and they say that a priest is to apply the perennial truth of the gospel to the concrete circumstances of life. We're to take this good news of the kingdom of the heavens being in our midst, this good news of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, paving a way for us to live the way that God has created us to live. We're to take this good news and apply it to the concrete circumstances of life. Because it's not just a priest's responsibility. The Bible says that the church is a royal priesthood, that we all now take on this responsibility of taking the truth and applying it to the concrete circumstances of life. To walk away having heard something interesting, and even to have discussed it among your peers, that's not quite enough. We need to end where James ends in this section of his letter. Whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they've heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. So, from hearing to discussing and all the way through to living it out, which is where we'll wrap up this series next Sunday morning. But for now, I'm going to wrap up this portion, and I'm going to send us out into the gym/fellowship hall, whichever you prefer. And we're going to gather around tables. Some of us will decide to stand and talk in the lobby. We'll share ideas and our experiences with one another. And my prayer is that we would be blessed as we do so. So I'm going to invite you to do that right now, to stand up, make your way through the lobby, hopefully land at one of the tables there. You know, this is one of those rare weeks where I'll know how effective the sermon was. So please help me out. And at 11 o'clock, we'll formally wrap up our time together. Thanks. Enjoy some good conversation.